I call this meeting the Judiciary Committee to order. Members and staff, this is our first remote hearing of the interim that we are live streaming. And before we get started, I'd like to go over a few things. We are holding this remote hearing pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which was passed on March 26th and allows for remote hearings to take place during the peacetime emergency. The rule sunsets on January 31st of 2021. Since this is an interim, we will not be conducting any official business. We will be taking the roll shortly, but today's hearing will be informational in nature and will not be walking through specific bill language. Rather, we're taking the opportunity to hear from practitioners in the field and stakeholders on ways in which the criminal justice system can work to reexamine and reevaluate the way our judiciary system currently works. So just a quick review of the remote hearing procedures for participants. Please keep yourself on mute when you're not voting or speaking. We will not be taking votes or rolls in this hearing with the exception of the roll call. While on mute, you can hold down your space bar to become unmuted. If you are on your computer, you can unmute yourself in the bottom left portion of your screen. The committee staff can mute and unmute you and will assist when we move to discussion. For those who call in to Zoom, you have to hit star six to unmute yourself, and you can raise your hand on the bottom of the screen to be noted by the committee administrator, who will send your name to me so I can recognize you. If you don't use the reaction function, thumbs up or clapping, because they'll disappear and they'll be difficult to track. If you're on your phone, you can hit star nine to raise your hand, or you can email Rachel Ganani or Jenna Mouse to notify us that you want to be heard. Thank you for being patient. We will be taking breaks periodically. I've been notified that we have a quorum present. So the committee legislative assistant will take the role.
Chair Lesh.
Present.
Representative Moeller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Here.
Representative Albright.
Present.
Representative Barr. Representative Cantrell.
Present.
Representative Carlson.
I'm here.
Considine. Representative Hassan. Representative Herr. Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Here.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Mariani. Representative Noor.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Mouse. And it looks like the Republicans have a working majority, so I'm glad we're not taking any votes today. Today, we're going to be covering four topic areas while discussing the broader subject of criminal justice reform in the judiciary. We're going to be talking about how we as policymakers who sit on the Judiciary Committee can guarantee that the courts of Minnesota ensure fair and just outcomes in the areas of forfeiture reform, which we've been talking about for a while, cash bail reform, also have been talking about this past year, not quite as long as forfeiture reform, court fines and fees, which we've been speaking about in some version since The original fees were increased in 2003 and 2005, and then record expungement that had been talked about for years and was finally passed. I know the House chief author was Representative Moline, and that occurred in 2015, so barely 5 years old. Well, these policy topics are not new, a lot of the bills have been introduced to talk about them in various forms. Today, we're going to be hearing from practitioners and issue area experts, as well as regular Minnesotans with firsthand knowledge to share with the committee. We'll center the informational hearing on listening to their perspectives and learning from their experience. And while we may certainly discuss possible solutions to the problems that exist in the current system, we will live parsing the bill language to the work of regular session when we can take votes and be held accountable for that. The nonpartisan background information on the four topics were distributed to committee members and posted to the committee page as well. So the first topic we're going to be getting into is forfeiture reform. This topic has been near and dear to me and something I've worked on for years and throughout multiple sessions. So you may be aware that this committee or members of this committee were first advised of some issues surrounding this in relation to the Metro Gang Strike Force. And there were efforts to change forfeiture, asset forfeiture reform prior to that. But after the troubles arising from the Metro Gang Strike Force in 2006 and 2007, the efforts were renewed in different versions. So I know that Lee McGrath, I'd worked with him on these various topics for probably almost 10 years. And then other folks have stepped in as well. The Institute for Justice has worked on this. And one interesting thing I find about this topic is that it's brought a coalition, an array of folks from the left and the right, which always makes the issue a lot more interesting than your stock caucus position on things. So that's one of the reasons that I like about this. But the most recent version I introduced during the 2020 session and reintroduced in both special sessions is a compromise bill between all those groups, which sought to bring stakeholders together from defense attorneys and civil liberty advocates to law enforcement folks. It didn't go as far as I and others would like, but it was a step in the right direction and would have made substantive change to the four areas of the current law: changes to DWI forfeiture, controlled substance forfeitures, changes to the federal sharing program, and changes to transparency and reporting. Now, of the coalition, there are two groups that did not sign off on this: the police chiefs and the Institute for Justice, one group on each side. It did not go as far as the Institute for Justice wanted, and it went too far for the chiefs, but that's where we found ourselves. So now I'll turn it over to our testifiers on the subject and our issue area. The first, we are lucky enough to be graced by the presence of one of our constitutional officers in the state of Minnesota, State Auditor Julie Blaha. So welcome, Auditor Blaha, to the committee. Please state your name for and title for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Chair Lesh, members of the committee. My name is Julie Blaha. I'm your state auditor. With me today is also our senior researcher, John Jernberg. He will, after the initial presentation, be available for questions. John has worked with our office for decades and has worked on this particular report for about that long. So we want to make sure that if you want to get in the weeds, we're ready for it. So to start, basically what I want to do is walk through our last report on asset forfeiture. I do appreciate that this committee is starting with the numbers. I think that's a great way to start. Let's get some basic understandings of the situation in Minnesota, and you all can build from there. So included in the attachments is the document. I'll go to a PowerPoint in a minute, but if you're following along at home, and you might want to have this available. When I refer to a page number, it will be in this document here. So to walk through, now this is a report that is basically commissioned by the legislature. So you direct my office to gather this data to help you make decisions. So as we're going through this, I hope not only will you be looking at the data itself, but also thinking about what you wish was available to you. You know, we are always looking to improve our reports so that any stakeholder can use them. So as you're looking at this, don't hesitate to think about things you may want to tell us about that. Maybe not in this hearing, but you can certainly send them my way. Really interested in hearing your background. So as we look at the forfeiture report, you'll notice that the report is dated 2018. That is our last report. We gave the report in August of 2019. We use audited data, so naturally there's a lag there, but that's the most accurate data that we can give you. Not only did John Jernberg, who I already introduced, work on this, but Kathy Doctor, our GID director, Government Information Division. Christy John, another researcher we have, does amazing work. Mark Albrado, Tiffany O'Neill, and Aaron St. Cyr have also helped us put these things together. The next page always has a description of what we do. In the short form, we oversee almost $40 billion in local government spending. The way the report is laid out, if you're taking a look at the table of contents, we have a summary. Then we start going into how it works and some big trends. And then most of the report are data tables. We'll talk a little bit more about those at the end, but it's a 300-page report. Don't let that intimidate you. And I know that legislators here, you live for this kind of stuff. But if you're watching at home, know that you don't have to read 300 pages to understand this report. You get through the first 23 and you are a pro. Also at the beginning, we like to have an executive summary, some of the most interesting trends that we saw in there. And I'll hit those as I walk through the report. So let's talk about scope and methodology. Basically, since 1992, we have been doing this report. This came again from the legislature. And as you take a look at the scope, and then included in the scope are a number of changes that the law went through. And you'll see there are several pages of changes. And I think what's important about that is this is why you may not see in this report really longitudinal trends. Because types of forfeiture changed a bit over time, it doesn't always make sense for us to show very long trends. So if you see a trend that's only going back 4 years, it makes sense because that's the data that really compares apples to apples. Basically what this is that people, that the entities that are doing forfeitures report to us, and then we compile them in a variety of ways. We have good compliance with this report. Our reporting is pretty solid. If we are missing a report, we give them a call. We usually are able to get that back in. So the data is relatively complete, which is, again, thing really important for this kind of a report. And so briefly, that's the background. Again, our job is to make your job easier. So let's get right to the numbers. So I'm going to now share my screen so that we have a chance to see the graphs, which I know when you're talking to this auditor's office, that's what you come here for. You'll also notice at the beginning here, I do want to just show off a bit our new logo. It's based on the idea of a magnifying glass. We take close looks at things. So just thought I'd show that off. We are rolling that out this year. All right, so let's start. If you look at page 9, the first trend that we talk about in our forfeiture report is basically just overall completed forfeitures. So remember that a forfeiture is not anything that may be seized in a situation, but these are the things that are up for forfeiture specifically. In addition, these are the forfeitures that fall under Minnesota state laws. So these are not federal forfeitures. These are the state level of forfeiture. I think that makes this report particularly useful to you since you are the people setting the laws that govern these specific forfeitures. So I think that this is extremely, I think, well tailored to the work that you do. Though I, at the end, will talk about how you can get some federal background too to help you get a more complete picture of what's going on. So if you take a look, since about 2014 to 2018, we saw a little bit of an uptick in the number of completed forfeitures. Now, spoiler alert, we have our next report is coming out toward the end of this month. We're in the final processes. I can't give you a lot of final numbers because we like them to be tight. We want them to be accurate. I can tell you, though, that 2019's numbers showed a little bit of a drop. So, we saw this uptick. We have a little bit of a downtick in the 2019 numbers. But again, we will, you'll get the exact stuff toward the end of the month. And we've also made sure that we're going to send out the new report and a chance to watch the press conference that we hold. We go through our new numbers coming up shortly. All right. So let's take a look at one of the next ideas that we look at. If you flip to page 11, you'll see the number of completed forfeitures by the proceeds range. So the size, value-wise, of the forfeitures. You'll see that the bulk of the forfeitures in 2018 were in the $100 to $500 range. Still were significant in numbers that were less than 100. And then you see smaller amounts going between from 500 to 1,000, 1,000 to 5,000, and 5,000 and above. And so one thing you'll see coming up in 2019, without being able to give you again exact numbers quite yet, that we're, the biggest change we're going to see is a drop in the $100 to $500 range. There will be a noticeable drop in those numbers. The rest of them will seem a little more steady, but there will be a shift in that area. When we talk about the numbers of completed forfeitures going down, that's about where we're seeing it happen in 2019. Okay. So let's look at what's seized when you're talking about the kind of property that's seized in Minnesota that's reported to us. Not surprisingly, as you see the rest of the report, vehicles are the big story when it comes to forfeiture in Minnesota. 61% of the forfeitures in 2019 were vehicles. There were cash, of course, some firearms. But remember, not every firearm that would be seized would necessarily be considered up for forfeiture. So that does not, that's one thing caveat I want to give you. Remember that this report doesn't cover everything that is seized. If you want to compare those things, you need to have wider data. This is about things that could go to forfeiture, that could have another kind of dispensation. But still, I think even if you include a lot of other things, vehicles are still really the story a lot of times in Minnesota. We go through, if you go let me just move my, blocking some of my view here. On page 12, we do break down some more specifics in this table about what is the gross sales, kind of the gross amount that is received off of these forfeitures. And we show a year-to-year change from 2017 to 2018. So you can see just that last year shift in there. Okay, you may know I'm going a little quick. I'm expecting that there'll be questions, of course. So that's why I'm leaving some room. And also you may want to take some time and dig into it after this as well. Now, the total number of controlled substance and DUI forfeitures from 2014 to 2018, you'll notice that they run pretty tight, controlled substances and driving under the influence forfeitures. A little bit of a change, but they do trend pretty close together. You'll see. And so which ones get completed? You'll notice that by far, the type of crime that has a forfeiture in Minnesota are DUI substance use types of crimes. Greatly outnumbering every other category in our state. Okay. So this part I know is other people will probably discuss in greater detail, but if you take a look at the type of forfeiture, the breakdown between administrative and judicial forfeiture in Minnesota. Now, remember that administrative forfeitures are the ones that go basically, this is by the way, we are counting this at the point of initiation. So we track it at right when it happens. What happens at that moment when it first comes in? How are you categorizing it? Are you categorizing it as judicial, going to be part of a criminal process, a judicial process, or are you keeping it administrative, where somebody would have to take an extra step to move it to a judicial process? And so the administrative ones are by far the majority of the type of forfeitures in Minnesota. Now, I want you to be a little careful with the numbers. This is one of our less precise numbers, even though the trend is still very clear. Not everyone reports this exactly the same, so I wouldn't go, tiny changes from year to year. But despite there being some variation in how people report it, still the trend is overwhelmingly, most of our forfeitures go the administrative route. And that's not, you can see it with controlled substances. You'll also see with DUIs, same kind of breakdown, very similar breakdown. very, yes, that's the last one we break out for administrative versus judicial. So now let's take a look at what happens in the end to property that is forfeited in Minnesota. You see 24% goes back to the owner in some way. You see that you see cash. Hang on here. Let me just do something here. There we go. Things that are just basically cash, 23%. 33% is sold. 2% is kind of repurposed in some way. There might be liens again, it's about 7%. And about 11% is destroyed, is junked in some capacity. So you do see some sales. I think that some people may not expect this breakdown to be quite like this, that but the sales are only 33% of things that are seized that are subject to forfeiture in that process. All right, so let's talk about the data that you get to dig into, if you choose to. What you'll see here is our table two. This is a big set of tables. We dig in.
I'm just going to break in for a second. We do have a couple of hands up. I'm not
already
wanted to let folks know that we're going to take those questions at the end of your presentation. Okay.
Oh, yes, thank you. Thank you. Then we'll get John in here too and get some more details. I'm almost finished and I'm excited for your questions. If you take a look at our tables in this report, you'll see that you can get into some detail. We break it down into very specific detail. So you'll see what are we building our numbers off of. And so we list all the data in this big table. This table is our biggest one. Starts on page 21. We also, on 264, so you can see how long that table is, go to page 264, and you'll see that we do a summary of activity by agency. So we also have it grouped by agency as a summary. Now, if you want to go trick this out yourself, and if you're wondering, that is my dad's rat rod, you know, when early on in the process, it's done now. It's a 1917 Overland, if you're wondering. But if you want to trick it out yourself, you can go to our website. Let me walk through where you find this data for yourself. If you start our main page, which will be getting a little bit of a facelift coming up, you go to reports and data, zip on down to criminal forfeiture. You'll see all of the reports that we have done that since 1996 are online. If you wanted something else, you could call us. We'll get it for you. Click on the report you're looking for, and you'll see that you can pull the full report. You can also fill the data tables in a PDF form. You can also pull it down as a spreadsheet. So if you want to pull down it as a spreadsheet, and you are certainly welcome to reorganize those numbers in a way that helps you. And in fact, if you do come to something that you find helpful, please let us know. If there's a sort that you're doing that you think is particularly illustrative, we'd like to know what that is. We may want to include it in our report as well. We also in here will, if you want to know kind of what are the drug and violent crime enforcement teams across the state that we refer to, we include the task forces in here and the areas they cover. If you'd like some information on that, this is a handy graph just to have, I think, for your committee in general. Then also, to get the full picture of forfeiture, asset forfeiture in Minnesota, you may also want to look in a couple more places. A lot of things are federal, go under the federal system. So we on page 3, at the very beginning, we provide links to the Department of Justice's pages on Minnesota's forfeiture that goes through them. We also suggest you take a look at the U.S. Department of the Treasury. They also may have forfeitures. They don't give as much data. Neither Department of Justice nor the Treasury give as much detail as the legislature asks of us, but they're still helpful to get a full picture of what's happening with forfeiture in Minnesota. So with that, also don't hesitate to write down my cell phone number there so that if we need to have a conversation, we are available to you, and we are always up to have a conversation about our data. So again, I thank you so much for the ability to have a conversation about these numbers. And with that, we stand ready, myself and John Jernberg stand ready for your questions.
Thank you very much for your presentation, Auditor Blaha. Before we move on, we have two questions. One from Representative Lucero. I don't know if there are any questions at this point, but before we move to Representative Lucero, I forgot to point out that Representative Considine and Representative Herr are excused from this meeting. I forgot to note that after the roll. So, but let's go to Representative Lucero. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And mine wasn't a question for Madam Auditor. It was more addressing your opening comments, which were this is an important piece of legislation that brings both the left and the right together and people like myself who are square up the middle. Thank you.
That is great. Thank you. I appreciated that. I'm going to start calling you up the middle, Lucero. So I don't know if that's an insult or not. I do have a question for Auditor Blaha. You had on there the number of forfeitures in the graph, and I'm not going to go back to that graph right now in your presentation, but I'm assuming on types of property seized, you have vehicles 61% and cash 25%. So I'm assuming that on vehicles, that 61% is not the number of vehicles, it's the cash value of those vehicles, because I don't know what you're counting on cash then, is that right?
Let me make sure that whenever I get super technical like this, I want to go to my pro here. So, Mr. Jernberg, if you're able to answer that.
Mr. Jernberg.
I think you still need to hit unmute on your end as well.
Oh, that would be Rachel. Rachel, can you?
There we go.
I think, can you guys hear me?
Yeah, talk a little louder. But.
Okay, sorry about that. I'm just looking. So Auditor Blaha showed table one, and that shows the number, the actual number of forfeiture, not by value, but by type of property. And so there were about 5,000 vehicles forfeited versus in 2018 versus about 2,000 of cash forfeitures. So that, you know, that's kind of the breakout between the two of those. It's not a dollar value thing. The value of the cash forfeitures actually exceeded the value of the vehicle forfeitures, but there were many more forfeitures of vehicles than there were of cash.
Okay, well, here's my confusion. 61% in the lavender slice of that pie, that's the number of that represents a number of vehicles?
That represents the number of the forfeiture incidences by type. So,
oh, I see. Okay. I get it. Okay. So the seizure of $5,000 is counted as one discrete integer, and the seizure of $50 would be in that 25% as well as two discrete integers. Is that right?
That is correct. Okay. So, in 2018, there is 8,091 forfeiture incidences. Of those, of that 8,091, there were about 4,950 that were vehicles and 1,995 that were cash incidences. Okay. So that's kind of how that breaks out.
So do you have another graph like this that shows where's the dollar value pie chart? Did I miss that?
I think.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no. Yeah. So I'm just saying, John, feel free, since I've got things up, feel free to tell me where to move in the report if needed.
I'm trying to think if we have a cash one.
Don't.
This one is really where it shows on table one that you have up there. That really gives you the breakdown of the value of each of these.
I see.
What the gross amount was, what either expenses related to a sales or amount that went back to a lien holder, or if there was an agreement where it's a $10,000 car valued at $10,000 and only $5,000 of it is you know, they come to an agreement that the owner pays $5,000 and gets their car back. So that's kind of where you get expenses, amount returned to owner or lien holder.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. And we have no more questions up, but I've been told by my CA that we're running long too. So thank you for that. Okay. And so thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Jernberg and Auditor Blaha. If you'll stick around in case other questions come up hereafter, we would very much appreciate it.
Absolutely. And again, thank you so much for starting with the data and giving yourself a good grounding to make good choices. So thank you. So glad to be here. Always happy to come and share our data with you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Jason Flores, Minnesota State Director for Americans for Prosperity. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Flores, and please state your name and title for the record. To begin.
Mr. Chairman, let me check, make sure first that you can hear me all right.
Yes, you're good. We can hear you.
Perfect. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jason Flores. I'm the State Director of the Minnesota Chapter of Americans for Prosperity. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to testify in support of reform for Minnesota's asset forfeiture process. These are reforms that both protect public safety and uphold constitutional private property protections for all Minnesotans. Changes to Minnesota's asset forfeiture laws are an important part of ongoing criminal justice reform efforts at both the state and federal level. We believe that an effective criminal justice system protects people and preserves public safety, respects human dignity, restores victims, removes barriers to opportunity for people who have earned a second chance, and ensures equal justice for all under the law. To that end, this package of reforms before you today reflects extensive negotiation between defense attorneys, justice reform advocates.
Is anyone else frozen, or is it just Mr. Flores that's frozen?
Okay. Mr. Chair, he froze for me as well.
Okay, you froze for about 5 seconds, Mr. Flores.
I apologize for that. I let me know if I have another issue, and I'll continue on.
Okay.
As I was saying, this package of reforms reflects extensive negotiation between a whole lot of what you referred to earlier as, you know, maybe unlikely or non-traditional allies. Started meeting last year and have devoted a significant amount of time and effort to get to this point. We believe that the agreed upon language will focus law enforcement's use of civil asset forfeiture on individuals who pose a legitimate threat to public safety and who will better and will be able to better safeguard civil liberties and the constitutional rights of Minnesotans. Now, as you know, civil asset forfeiture allows the government to seize and permanently keep money, vehicles, other property, all suspected of being connected to criminal activity. Even if an individual is never charged with a crime, their property can be seized and ultimately forfeit. Now, under current law, people wishing to reclaim that seized property must engage in expensive, very time-consuming litigation in order to get their property back, which oftentimes costs much more than the value of the seized currency or property itself. As the state auditor referred to earlier, most people, 95% of people in Minnesota, they make the economically rational choice to simply walk away from their own property. The current system burdens not only property owners, but it also negatively impacts law enforcement by creating administrative burdens throughout the process, including storage and sale and management of vehicles, all at a significant cost to taxpayers. Policing practices must build community trust and foster collaboration in order to protect public safety. And that trust grows when law enforcement is able to focus resources on preventing and solving serious crime. And these reforms ensure that they retain the tools to do so. But continuing in a broken status quo perpetuates structural barriers to good policing. It contributes to a negative perception of law enforcement, and it also disproportionately impacts low-income and economically disadvantaged communities across the state. Now, I think we're going to get into a lot more detail, so I just want to highlight a couple of key reforms that came out of our coalition efforts. First, this package reforms DWI forfeiture statutes to expand the use of ignition interlock into treatment courts and focus seizure and forfeitures on repeat offenders. It provides additional protections for innocent owners with recent Minnesota Supreme Court decisions. It prevents circumvention of state forfeiture laws by accessing the federal sharing program. It establishes thresholds for money and property that can be subject to forfeiture unless there is probable cause that that property or currency was directly used in the commission of certain crimes. It creates transparent reporting requirements for forfeited property and the use of forfeiture revenue by local municipalities. It waives some storage fees and filing fees for individuals for innocent owners, and requires a recidivism study to actually track the effectiveness of forfeiture and ignition interlock as strategies to help reduce repeat DWI offenses. Now, these are substantial and comprehensive changes, and they're the result of careful work in consultation with stakeholders at all stages of the process, some of whom you'll hear about, you know, later in this committee hearing. But I want to say thank you for taking the time to consider these reforms and for the opportunity to express not only Americans for Prosperity support, but the support of our broad coalition as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Flores. We do have a question from Chair Scott. Chair Scott, you got a question?
I'm just getting to it. Thank you. I actually had a question back for the state auditor, if that's appropriate, Mr. Chair, at this time.
Yes, go ahead.
And it's kind of unrelated to what we're talking about, but she mentioned, as we all know, we have a budget deficit that we're facing here. And I noticed that she said that she has a new logo, and I'm just wondering if we could find out what the cost of that logo was.
I'm very excited about this. What we did was, you've seen that what I did was I used somebody from Attorney General's office. You know, they redid some of their layouts. We have a number of just, we haven't changed the formatting on any of our items for almost 50 years. Right. So we actually are having things that don't work anymore. We just need new graphics because they pixelate and all kinds of problems. So we spent, I believe it was $500. What I did was I used somebody from the Attorney General's office, Casey Weber, who does wonderful work on graphics. And from there, we're simply using that in every other place. And then all the rest of any other cost of changing things over is just internal, just absorbed with our regular work. We're just moving it in slowly so that we don't have to like stop and do a full redo. So about $500.
Perfect. That's my question. Only question. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the levity there. Thank you.
By the way, if you ever want, I cannot recommend Casey Weber enough for all of your graphic needs.
I like the plug. We're going to thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Flores. If you can stick around for questions in case we have them, we're moving on to Mr. Small with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Small. It's always great to have you. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Robert Small. I'm the executive director of the County Attorneys Association. First of all, I want to thank Mr. Flores for shortening up my testimony. He covered so much of what I was going to start out with. And so I thought that maybe I would move on into my shortened testimony and talk about some of the criticism of the compromise agreement that folks may have heard about. And I'd like to address those issues. First, a key change and that was proposed in the reform is a new threshold for currency. Currently, there is no limit. And as Mr. Flores would attest and others that were part of the stakeholder group, there were some who wanted to maintain the status quo and not have a threshold at all. There were others who wanted a higher threshold. There were others who wanted a lower threshold. And the $1,500 thresholds for currency strikes the right balance. It was something that was debated and discussed among all the stakeholders, and all the stakeholders agreed that that was the right balance. Now, there may have been some discussions about law enforcement entities who are fighting significant drug trafficking issues in their community. I would note that if there is probable cause to believe that the money was exchanged for the purpose of drugs, then the threshold would not apply. With this provision, there would be little, if any, impact on smaller communities fighting drug trafficking. Now, I want to thank the state auditor for going through all those data points. I went through her report yesterday, and my numbers may be a little different because I did the hand counting, but about 17% of the cash forfeitures fall above the threshold, the $1,500 threshold. So that is 83% are under the threshold that was established in the bill. And so for those 83%, and not all of them are drug cases, some of them, as you go through the report that the state auditor so thoroughly prepared, you'll see that some of the cash forfeitures and other offenses. So they're not all, all the cash are not all drug related. But if there's probable cause for those other 83% to demonstrate that, and the prosecutor has that responsibility to show that, then that threshold shouldn't apply. And so that's, I wanted to talk about that criticism that you may have heard about. Secondly, you may have heard about criticism and significant discussion about the perceived lack of due process in the civil forfeiture proceedings. And that that would be supposedly strengthened by combining the civil and criminal proceedings. I would note that the bill ensures the protection of people's due process rights. And they are built on existing due process law for criminal defendants, for innocent owners, for bona fide lien holders, while also ensuring that drug dealers could not be profiting from their endeavors. So it strikes the right balance, and it also, as Ms. Flores noted, with the addition of the ignition interlock provisions, as well as limiting the types of repeat drug driving offenses that would be subject to forfeiture, that those provisions strengthen the deterrence for drunk driving, I'm sorry, DUIs. So it also, as Mr. Flores noted, it makes it easier for folks, including innocent owners, to engage in the civil process. For example, the bill only requires that the property owner notify the prosecutor that they would contest the forfeiture, and then the burden shifts to the prosecutor to initiate the process and follow through on that process if the government wants to continue with that forfeiture. I would also note that, as Mr. Flores noted, there were public defenders, the private defense lawyers, and the prosecutors were all involved in arriving at this compromise, and all agreed that the combining of the civil and criminal procedure would be fraught with way too many problems. It would be too complex. It would be too burdensome on the defendant and would take way too long to get a resolution. So after several conversations about how the goal of combining those two processes could be achieved, the practitioners, the ones who do this, agreed that a separate process with improved safeguards is the better approach and the better route to take. Lastly, Mr. Chair, I would be remiss if I didn't conclude my comments by thanking you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for your thoughtful review and hearing this proposal, both during the session and continuing our discussions here today. Minnesota supporting this is very important to protect the public. And since the time of this compromise was reached and that hearings have been held and legislation advanced, I have not received any contacts from anyone opposed to this legislation with suggested ways to improvement. This is an effort that deserves broad stakeholder support, as it has. It deserves bipartisan support. And I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for hearing us out.
Well, absolutely. Mr. Small, thank you. We have two questions, Chair Johnson and Chair Liebling. Before I go to those, I want to say that, Mr. Small, that, my bill went farther than what the compromise was. And that's what I would prefer. But the effort that you and your coalition demonstrated in coming together on this means a hell of a lot to me. And I feel like compromise has become a dirty word around the Capitol in recent years. And yet that's the only way we've ever got anything done. That's the only way we've ever moved the needle. So in the interest of respecting that, the effort and the work you put into it, I put my name on that bill and put it in, and I support it and will continue to support it. And I want to thank you for that. What you did, you guys hired a mediator. You went, above and beyond the call of duty to try to reach a compromise. I recognize that. I respect the work that you put into it. And quite frankly, in my opinion, it's a lot higher calling to try to reach agreement than it is to stand your ground and say, hell no, we won't go. So thank you for that. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, members, I want to thank Judge Small for the work he did on this. He took care of one of the serious problems I had with it, and that was the threshold on drug charges and the drug money. While we were talking about it, I got a hold of one of my contacts to find out how much $100 in cash, if that got down to the cartel, how much in methamphetamine it would produce and get back up to this community. And he informed me that between 1 to 200 pounds of methamphetamine is what it costs them to produce it and get it up to Minnesota for $100, yet they sell it for hundreds of thousands. So every dollar we can get out off the streets that's used for drugs is drugs not going to the cartel in Mexico, getting more up here. And I appreciate him for getting it so the drug charge or the drug stuff is not included in the cap. But I do have one other concern that's happening a lot in St. Cloud. We've had a huge issue with it, and it's happening all over Minnesota. We have that $1,500 cap. It could create more problems. That's in the sex trafficking. We're getting a huge issue with that. And maybe we need to look at also in if it's the cash funding and the stuff is involved in sex trafficking, that there should not be a threshold on that either. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Johnson. Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm not sure if it's Mr. Small is the person to answer this. I was going to mention it indeed when Mr. Flores was speaking, but the thing that continues to concern me about our forfeiture legislation or the way we have it now is that police departments and prosecutors get a cut of the proceeds from forfeitures. And I'm not sure if, Mr. Chair, if your legislation changes that. I think it doesn't, if I remember correctly. But going off of what Mr. Flores was saying, I totally agree with what he said, which is very interesting, strange bedfellows, all of that's probably nothing else we agree about. But I think that having police agencies, and especially having prosecutors get a cut of proceeds from forfeitures undermines confidence in those agencies. And the piece that prosecutors get is more recent in the law. I kind of remember that happening. And it just floors me because as lawyers, they should most understand how that appearance of impropriety, whether or not it impacts them at all, just the appearance undermines their legitimacy. And especially at this time, when a vast swath of the public is questioning police agencies and questioning law enforcement, to have this still go on is deeply troubling. So I'd really like someone to address sort of the current status of that and how we can continue to justify the people who are deciding about the forfeiture getting a piece of the money from it. This policing for profit that has been talked about for a long time continues to happen. I will be quiet and take an answer from whoever would care to respond.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Anyone want to take a shot at that? Judge Small.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling. I don't know if the state auditor would agree with me or not, but if we're policing for profit, we're doing a real horrible job. If you look at those numbers, particularly on the vehicle forfeitures, but that aside, the important part, and Representative Liebling, I hear you, and I think that everybody that was involved hears you as well. And one of the things that is in the bill is increased transparency in both the reporting of each forfeiture. There's lots of requirements for reporting, having it made public, having it out there, reporting on where that money goes and how it is used. And so that transparency is there and is significantly increased with this bill. It doesn't eliminate what your concern is, and I hear you and I understand that. We thought that at least the first step was to get everything out there and let everybody see what it is we're taking in and why we're taking it in and what we're using it for. And I'll let Mr. Flores add on anything for that.
Mr. Flores?
I don't know if I could say it any better. I think those transparency pieces that are in this bill are the next important step so that we know exactly what we're talking about. The public and lawmakers can see that information and make decisions from there. We share the same concerns, but want to have that better access and transparent data first, and then we'll have those discussions.
And Chair Liebling, I would say this, when Representative Knobloch had this bill, I thought, hey, wow, you know, the chair of Ways and Means can maybe fund the gap that law enforcement had. Because, you know, I asked the ED of the Sheriff's Association when he came in on the hearing, does he really think this is a good way to fund law enforcement? And he said, well, no, it's not a good way to fund it. And yeah, I also know that law enforcement agencies are screaming for funds. I also, the last time I checked these statistics was from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, that 83% of law enforcement agencies in the state of Minnesota are funded at the local level. Okay. And so the only funds they get are property taxes or LGA. And so they're looking for any stopgap they can get, which makes them very resistant to end that, what I think the agencies themselves in general would agree is a bad way to get funded. So I agree with you. That's all I want to say. Did you have any other comments or question, Chair Liebling?
Well, just I guess just to kind of close the loop on it, I think this is a big, big deal. And it might be 2 cents. It doesn't matter. It's an appearance thing. It has to end. I frankly don't care if the police agencies don't want to give up the money. I mean, this has got to go. No police agency should be deciding on its own funding, even if it's 5 cents. So I feel very strongly about that. And this issue is not going to go away, especially now, with so much questioning, and no amount of transparency is going to change it. I'm sorry. So just wanted to put that out there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Liebling, for that. With that, there's much more to discuss on this, but we are over time. We're going to move on to the cash bail reform conversation. I'd like to recognize our committee member, Representative Noor, to give a little bit of background before hearing from our testifier on that. Representative Noor, go ahead. And while you're getting ready to go ahead, Representative Noor, I wanted to note that in one of our previous hearings, a member of the media noted that you had the best lighting and the best camera setup of anyone on Zoom. So very nice job on that. And I assume you will too when you pop up here in a second. Representative Noor may have stepped away since we went over time on our last one. In the interest of time, let's go to court fines and fees and then move back to Representative Noor on the cash bail reform. So the next topic that we're going to move in front will be, we're going to move the third one to the second one. Court fines and fees is also near and dear to me. It's something I've been working on for years in multiple sessions. Oh, wait a second. Representative Noor is here. You look great. Good lighting, good background, Representative Noor. You look fantastic. So why don't we, we will do our cash bail reform now. Do you want to give a few comments before we move to Ms. Decker from the ACLU, Rep. Sumner? You're muted, by the way. There you go.
All right, can you hear me?
Yes.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I know we have talked about this issue of cash bail. The problem with cash bail system is that if you have money, you can buy your freedom. And if you don't, you end up in jail. That's what we've been calling criminalization of poverty. When someone gets arrested, they're accused of a crime and they're innocent until proven guilty. The majority of people who are sitting in jail awaiting their trial are on minor offenses, minor crimes, and nothing that makes us worry about public safety. Members, this issue disproportionately impacts low-income individuals, Black, Brown, and Indigenous people who don't have the financial ability to pay for cash bail. And when bail gets set, if that person has $78, $100, $500 to pay for cash bail, they get to go home. They get to go to their families. They get to go back to their jobs. They get to fight their case while they're sitting outside. They get to enjoy that presumption of innocence. But if they don't, they lose their freedom. It impacts their livelihood and may lose their jobs, lose their custody for their children because there's nobody else to take care of them. And they may even lose their homes for inability to pay for rent. And they may become homeless because they could not pay cash bail. What we also know is that when someone is sitting in jail, they're more likely to plead guilty just to get out and avoid sitting in jail. Members and Mr. Chair, no one should be in jail because they're poor. Everyone deserves to be treated with dignity and respect. Our justice system needs to apply equally to each person, regardless of their financial ability. Members, this is a topic that we need to address. With that, I just wanted to welcome Ms. Decker to explain some of the parts of the cash bail. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome back to the committee. Ms. Decker, please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just quick sound test, everything is good with the video? Great. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Noor, for championing this issue of bail reform. My name is Julia Decker. I'm the policy director at the ACLU of Minnesota. So today we are hearing about, you know, we're hearing about ways in which systems that purport to promote accountability and public safety actually disproportionately harm people in poverty. And the pretrial system is one of these systems. It stands at the very entry point to the criminal, legal, and incarceration systems. It disproportionately harms low-income folks and people of color and can lead to a cascade of harmful consequences, as Representative Noor talked about. And so because of this, pretrial justice reform, including but not limited to bail reform, really needs to be a key area of focus for this body. As Representative Noor noted, the core problem with cash bail is this. Two people charged for the same crime, charged, not convicted, may face very different situations and ultimately very divergent consequences because one of them can pay their bail while the other can't. A person who can't pay their bail is stuck in jail for the duration of their case. This can be weeks or months. Separation from family and support networks, loss of jobs, housing, exacerbation of physical and mental health issues. These conditions and the pressure, the prospect of losing these essential life necessities means that people are going to do whatever is necessary to get out of jail as quickly as possible, even if that means potentially taking a less than favorable plea deal. All of that stemming from that inability to pay the cash bail. Now, simply put, this is a wealth-based system that incarcerates legally innocent people, exposes them to unnecessary harms and hardships, and hampers their access to full and equal justice solely because they're poor. And this is a wealth-based inequality that has to end. Now, ending cash bail is one component of this, but the bill that Representative Noor had last session represented a good first step, but we do urge this body to go further and end cash bail without any exceptions. A a person's wealth does not inherently make them more or less dangerous. It does not make them more or less likely to commit a crime. All it does is make them more or less likely to be able to pay that cash bail that allows them to be released from pretrial detention. Moreover, people facing bail under this current system that we have are awaiting trial. They have not been convicted. And to put a fine point on that, they are legally innocent. Now, in addition to cash bail, there are other pretrial systems that contribute to wealth-based inequality. And these systems that impose monetary costs on people in the criminal legal system and therefore disproportionately burden low-income folks in that system should be examined. It should be restructured and potentially eliminated. Reforming and restructuring all of these pretrial systems, including cash bail, requires a committed and concerted effort on the part of this body to do it right. Cash bail is just one part of the web of wealth-based mechanisms that set up and then amplify the disproportionate harms inflicted by the criminal legal system on low-income folks and communities of color. And so the ACLU of Minnesota really looks forward to being part of those conversations, looks forward to working with this body on that issue moving forward. And we thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Decker. I do not see any questions. If questions pop up for you, we will ask that you stick around to answer some of those, but thank you very much for your presentation. We will be talking more about this next session, and especially the cash bail reform piece is going to be an important part of, I think, any package that comes through next year. And I want to thank the ACLU for being such a critical part of that. Moving on to the court fines and fees, I'll restart. Oh, wait a second. Questions from Chair Johnson and Representative O'Neill. Go ahead, Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Ms. Decker, you had mentioned you were talking. I believe I heard you said the totally eliminating cash bail. Does that also include for somebody that commits a homicide? I'm wondering that as well.
Ms. Decker.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, we would take the position that there should be no exceptions to eliminating cash bail. And the reason for that is the core issue here is not the seriousness of a criminal charge. The core issue is that it all depends on wealth, that a person's ability to get out based on bail depends on their wealth and not any finding of dangerousness or risk of harm. So two people who were charged with the same crime will face very different situations in terms of whether, based solely on whether they can pay the bail or not.
Thank you, Chair Johnson.
Yes, that's real interesting to me. Because bail is set usually our Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, require a bail be reasonable to the person. A person with multiple millions of dollars should have a much higher bail than somebody that doesn't have anything. Bail is a guarantee and a promise that you'll appear in court. Now, when we first started this process a few years ago, we had the Minneapolis prosecutor talking about the $35 bail when somebody was sitting on a traffic offense. I believe she came to the wrong place to fix that issue for her, because she is required by the city charter that anybody in the city of Minneapolis, they have to post bail. That's in their charter. They need to fix their charter to fix that issue for those minor traffic offenses where they have bail. But I have a serious problem if you have no bail for somebody that commits a homicide, commits a rape. These people are dangerous. Just because you don't have any money, yes, they're going to set that bail level to an area that you can afford, but is going to make you promise to appear in court if you do post that bail. And somebody has got billions of dollars, they're going to set that really high because it's easier for them to leave the country. Now, bail is important. It needs to be done right. But I don't think a lot of people know how bail is set. Bail is set when the prosecutor requests it, and the prosecutor requests the amount. and has to justify before the judge why he wants that, or he or she wants that amount of bail. Now, the defense attorney says, no, we don't need that much. We'll agree to a smaller amount or be released on personal recognizance. And the judge has to make a decision whether it's high or low based on the abilities of that person. And if they have filled out the paperwork for a public defender, the judge understands that they have little or no income, and he sets that bail accordingly. And going without bail, I think, is more dangerous to the public safety. Even the mayor of New York, where they've done this, has said they need to revisit it because they're letting people out on serious charges. They're going out and actually killing people. For those of you who want no accountability, for those who commit or are accused of committing crime, you're endangering the public. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Representative O'Neill.
I asked this question multiple times as you come before multiple committees. Can you give us any statistics on how often this happens? And I believe your bill is still dealing with misdemeanors. How often folks
Could everyone hear that question? You sounded a little choppy to me, Representative O'Neill. Maybe you can try that again.
I will try that again. Let me do something here to quickly. Okay. One question is, we've asked every single member in NORC has come before either this committee or public safety. The statistics on how many people actually do sit in jail if they can't pay bail.
Could you hear that question, Representative Noor?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I had the question. It's about the numbers, statistics of how many people have been impacted by this. Quite frankly, it's a significant number when it comes to the metro area. I have an intern who is actually working on gathering that data. Since we don't have specific data that we can point to. So it's something that I'm working on right now, especially with COVID-19, with so many individuals who are now actually released from jail, waiting for their trial. So it's something that we need to look into, how things have happened. Those are all things that we're considering, and I look forward to bringing some numbers and statistics on this issue sooner than later.
Thank you, Representative Noor. Representative O'Neill, any follow-up?
Well, it's a little disappointing, Chair, because since he began to introduce the legislation that been probably, I would think that somewhere this is such an issue. It'd certainly be nice to know how many people we're talking about. So I'm disappointed that we still don't know all these months later.
Thank you. I see no other hands up for the time. And members, we will have further discussion about this between the interim and as we move into regular session, or maybe even special session when we can do something, and we'll be able to address those topics and questions there as well. For now, we'll move on from this topic and over to the fines and fees discussion. As I stated, we have some issue area experts that are here to advise us on their perspective on this. From my perspective, members, this was important to me ever since, I guess it was 2003 and 2005, when we began to add on tack fines and fees onto folks that got charged with any level of crime in order to supplement the costs of public safety. And we were told at the time that this was temporary, that it would go back down and we wouldn't tax surcharges onto these folks. And I was a prosecutor for the city of St. Paul at the time, and I saw that the impact that this had on people. There are many people that said, forget it, I can't pay the surcharge. I'm not going to get tacked on the charge or the benefit of being called into court. And the caseloads just increased. The trials increased, and it was a complete pain in the rear to have to deal with it. And we went through several surpluses since then, including in 2000, 2007, I believe it was, then 2013. In none of those surpluses did we reverse course on this. And as a person who's been in long enough to remember the problem, I want to be around long enough to fix it. So with that, I will introduce, there are several testifiers, Mary Ellen Heng, Minneapolis Deputy City Attorney, Camille Bryant, Assistant Public Defender, Susie Green, Transportation Advocate, Community Action Duluth, Ismail Dorr, an organizer for the ACLU of Minnesota, and Derek Moore, resident of Minneapolis. So the first testifier we have is Mary Ellen Heng. Ms. Heng, welcome back to the committee. Thank you for participating in this. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lesh said, I am Mary Ellen Heng. I am the Deputy City Attorney of the Criminal Division in Minneapolis, the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office. My office prosecutes misdemeanor offenses for the city of Minneapolis, many of which are driver's license related, and that's the part that I'm going to talk about today. I agree with Chair Lesh's comments about the fees and the surcharges. I've been a prosecutor for 23 years, and when I started, I think the surcharge was in the $20 range, and now it's $75, and it's non-waivable, and sometimes it's often more than the fines that we impose for the violations. But in speaking about our driver's license reform that we're asking you guys to consider, a few points that I want to make is, and I think especially more so now with COVID and how that's affected the court system, prosecuting people who are driving after suspension, and the difference is you're suspended for a financial reason, for not being able to pay your fines and fees. Revocation comes when you do something like drive drunk, drive without insurance. It's an action-based offense that has public safety implications, but driving after suspension is you received a ticket and you did not pay that ticket for whatever reason. And those tickets can end up adding on late fees and others and become quite expensive. I've seen through my work in the DDP, one ticket, if there's multiple charges, a person could owe $800 or $900 before they pay that ticket off. In my office last year, just in court, we prosecuted 430 driving after suspensions. St. Paul prosecuted 410. Those are just the cases that made it to the court system. There's hundreds more that are being handled in the Violations Bureau or simply not being handled because people don't know what to do to take care of those offenses. Right now, we are in the midst of kind of a slowdown in the court. We are doing very limited court hearings with COVID, and these cases are not priority cases for us. Our priority are DWIs and domestic assaults and gross misdemeanors, and to continue to cite people for this offense and bring them into the court system just is frankly not a very good use of our judicial resources, especially in light of what we're facing. Both in Hennepin and Ramsey, we're facing thousands of backlog cases that we need to figure out how to handle. And I would rather see my office put our resources towards those offenses that impact public safety or where we have a victim that we're trying to get justice for, rather than prosecute someone for driving when they were not able to afford to pay off their tickets. I also think that driving after suspension, I just got done saying it's not a priority because we're prioritizing cases that impact public safety. These cases do impact public safety in other ways. When someone is driving without a license, it's also highly likely that they're not going to have insurance. And as a prosecutor, my goal is to have licensed and insured safe drivers on the road. And the more we tack on convictions, the higher insurance rate become, and we make it almost impossible for people who want to drive legally and safe and have valid insurance to afford insurance rates. And so these cases have that impact on public safety when we have licensed and uninsured drivers on the road. I also think that this is really relevant to everything that's been discussed since the incident in Minneapolis when we were talking about criminal justice reforms. When drivers are pulled over for status offenses such as driving without a license, the officers can run their plates and they can tell that they don't have a license. these traffic stops can often be expanded or lead to unwanted confrontation. And we've seen the results play out in many, many cases across this state. And this is one way, along with bail reform and others, that we can make a significant impact on justice reforms by stopping the suspension of licenses based on the inability to pay. The other impact it can have is, again, related to the bail reform. Here in Hennepin County, we no longer book individuals for driving offenses, misdemeanors, but that is a Hennepin County unique process that we have created. If I'm driving outside of Hennepin County, if an officer believes I'm going to continue to drive on my suspended license, they can, under the rules of criminal procedure, book me into jail, where then I have to post bail in order to be released. Or if I don't post bail, I can be held in jail on my DAS. And again, I think we're looking for bail reform. I want to make sure that the right people are in jail for the right reasons. And certainly someone who cannot afford to pay their tickets is probably not the right person that we need in jail at this time. The last point I'd like to just state is I know that there's some concern about the fiscal impact that not having these offenses and the reinstatement fees. And my issue with that is somewhat the same issue I have with the court surcharges. I do not believe we should be funding public safety, funding programs, funding the courts on the backs of defendants. Many of these defendants, if they cannot afford to pay their fines and fees, they're not going to be able to afford to pay a reinstatement fee or a surcharge. Certainly there was a lot of discussion years ago about law enforcement writing tickets simply to get quotas and fund their departments. I don't see how this is any different, and we need to find other ways to fund the systems that protect us and the court systems that, and it certainly shouldn't be based on hoping that defendants are going to pay reinstatement fees. So I appreciate the opportunity to once again talk about this bill. I hope that you'll give it some strong consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Hang, and for your cooperation and work on this issue, this because of how important it is. Camille Bryant, Assistant Public Defender, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, thank you for having me. My name is Camille Bryant. I'm an Assistant Public Defender in Hennepin County. I also have been tracking this legislation for the Minnesota Association of Black Lawyers. I've practiced as a public defender for 13 years in Hennepin County, and I just want to draw your attention to what it takes to qualify for a public defender. In order to qualify for a public defender, a client must make no more than $15,613 a year if they are single. If they are in a family of four, no more than $32,188. To put that in perspective, the average cost of housing in the city of Minneapolis is roughly $19,000 per year. I've represented persons charged with felonies, but for the past 2 years, I've been representing people charged with solely with misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors. It is normal for me to have multiple clients who have multiple strings of driving after suspension cases. 24 is not unusual. 5, 10 is also not unusual. I rarely had felony clients with a string of driving after suspension cases. For each of these cases, there's a fine, a late charge, a reinstatement fee. If it's resolved in court, there's a public defender surcharge and sometimes a fine attached on top of that. Until those charges are paid, clients cannot get their license violated. The first question I'm always asked when with my clients in court is, are they valid? If they are not valid, we may refer them to a program to get help in order to get valid, which leads to additional court appearances. There's at least one driving program which clients sometimes find on their own that actually leaves clients worse off than if they had left it alone altogether. When I collectively look at my clients' tickets and the corresponding police reports, there are some common trends that emerge. First, it's common to find multiple tickets issued around the same time of day on the same stretch of road by the same police officer over a period of time. These clients are almost always Black men. The stops are almost always initiated because the police officers ran their plates opposed to some driving behavior. These tickets and charges set our clients on a cycle of indebtedness to the state. It puts them in the challenging position of knowingly breaking the law to travel to and from work, to drop their kid off to daycare, to manage their lives, or to have to rearrange their lives or lose their jobs or choose another job in order to accommodate the fact that their license is. My question to you is, are these the outcomes intended by the statute? If it's not, then they need to be changed. And I thank you and appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Bryan. I think that's key as to whether or not they've been intended. And over my 18 years in the legislature, I've watched statutes aggregate to greater and greater originally unintended effects. And you seeing that boots on the ground is really important for us to be reminded of. Thank you for your work on this. Ms. Susie Green, Transportation Advocate, Community Action Duluth, is with us. And I'll keep looking for questions on my list here in case there are questions for Ms. Hanger, Ms. Bryant as well too. So thank you for sticking around. Ms. Green?
Hi.
Oh, there you are. I see a flower vase.
Yeah.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Green. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Susie Green. Good day to everybody. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, committee members, to speak with you all. Again, my name is Susie Green, and I'm currently a program supervisor doing transportation work for Community Action Duluth. I've been doing this work since 2016, working with individuals and families to remove their barriers. Transportation is a significant barrier for people of color and of lower income, making it difficult for them to access the resources and opportunities needed to thrive financially and socially. The transportation programming that we have here at Community Action Duluth addresses these barriers, and we also offer various programs to meet people's needs to remove their barriers. Myself, I did not have a driver's license until later in life. I racked up thousands of dollars in fines beginning at the age of 17 years old. I was pulled over for traffic citations. I couldn't pay the fine, and I kept getting pulled over, right? And then I would drive for an amount of time. My vehicle would be known by the police department, and then I would get pulled over, my vehicle taken, and I would get tickets for driving after suspension, driving after revocation, no insurance, and it just became this cycle. I would then work to get another vehicle, unfortunately. I had kids to take care of and a family that I had to transport. I incurred these fines and fees, and eventually, you know, now I'm a Black woman driving illegally in Duluth, Minnesota, a predominantly white community. The time came for me to sacrifice and prioritize, and I knew that. I worked with the state of Minnesota to be able to get my driver's license back. I learned about sacrificing and making priorities to begin to drive legally. I also understood that transportation became pivotal and extremely important piece of me becoming successful, getting out of poverty, and then also breaking the generational cycles of not having transportation and needing to become engaged with my community. And so right now, working on transportation issues with Community Action Duluth, it looks like for me, I go to the courthouse. I'm in front of judges alongside of my participants. I'm going for support. I'm at the DMV listening for understanding of where their barriers are so that I can understand the process that the state's put in place to then convey to my participants who sometimes just are not understanding what exactly the steps are to get the driver's license back. I work almost daily with payment offices in various Minnesota counties. It can be discouraging for my participants to not have a sense of guidance. And so I'm there to essentially lighten their load and kind of be the bridge between system and participants. I've spoken at the Capitol before on the work that I'm doing in Duluth. I'm very big on changing policy. We want to change the narrative. I do love my job. I love working with the community. But ultimately, we want transportation equity to be equitable for everybody. And so working with the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition, I've aligned myself and the agencies with their ongoing policy campaigns that are consistently expressed at a high level of support and concern, and that's driver's license reform and fines and fees reform. I'll leave you with this one, a quote that I like to tell individuals, and that is, access to transportation is the crucial link to people's success, self-determination, and the ability to participate in their community. And so thank you.
Thank you very much for that story, Ms. Green. Your experience is exactly the reason of why we brought these bills. And, you know, highlighting Ms. Bryant's statement about, you know, is this really the intent that we had when we enacted all of these? What you experienced in going through, I think I can safely say for most of the legislature, no, it's not. It is not what we intended. Now, there are some legislators say, well, you know, not our fault. You know, you do the crime, you do the time. And it's very binary about the fact you make one mistake and you've earned the weight of the world of having to claw your way back up. I think for most legislators, that's not the case, which is why we should be able to reform this. You don't have to go through what you've been going through to try to achieve. So thank you for that. Thank you for your story and for being a transportation advocate for folks that maybe don't have the resources to step up to the legislature and testify or the time to do it. And you put your time forward and do it. And thank you for that.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Next testifier, Ismail Dorr with the ACLU. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent. Begin your testimony. You're muted. I see on the next page and you're muted. Take yourself off mute there. There we go.
Can everybody hear me now?
Yes, can hear you. Thank you.
Great. I was saying good afternoon to everyone in attendance today. My name is Ismail Dorr. Today I'm proud to be here as an organizer with the ACLU of Minnesota. However, my journey here was difficult and my story is difficult to share, but I want to share it so everyone can have an idea as to how much of a burden excessive fines and fees can be on an individual as well as their family and their community. Because as you see, I know the impacts personally of excessive fines and fees and driver's license suspensions all too well. Several years ago, I got some traffic tickets, but I had no money to pay for them. I was in the first stages of homelessness, just trying to get on my feet to take another year of college. And I was also living out of my 1999 Nissan Altima, and literally everything I owned was in my car. And one day I parked my car in downtown Minneapolis to run errands. When I came back, it was gone. I found out the city had towed it. I would continuously go down to the impound lot to get my car back, but the amount of money that I owed just continued to go up every day. And I was never even allowed to retrieve any of my belongings that were of importance to me or that I really needed at the time. I was not informed about a deadline to get my car back. And so the day that I finally made enough money to retrieve it, I found out the city had claimed possession of my vehicle and all the belongings in it, only for them to turn around and sell it. So I lost, you know, my laptop, birth certificate, passport, all my clothes, plus stuff I could never replace, like some art and jewelry that were gifts from family in Africa, items of culture that I can't put a price on. I was doing the best that I could being homeless and living out of a car, but losing my car put me in a state of desperation because now I really had nothing and things fell apart for me. I was flat broke and it was a cold Minnesota winter and I had to survive. Before, you know, I could drive to a family member's house, spend some time, I could couch hop, find places to lay my head for the night, but losing my car made me full-time homeless and on the streets, sleeping on the light rail train and skyways and parking ramps downtown Minneapolis. And it was rough. It was nothing but survival. Ultimately, I ended up incarcerated. After I was released, I didn't have any money to start paying off those fines and fees, and my license was suspended. So, you know, I tried working with different counties to figure something out. It only worked partially. I still owed a lot. I knew I had to find a job and get some income. And at this time, I was living with my mother in Little Canada, where there's not much easy access to public transit. And so to get to work, I felt as if I had no other choice but to drive, regardless, you know, of my suspended license. And that just led to me with more tickets, with driving with the suspended license, no insurance, you know, driving after revocation, more than the initial number of tickets that I had to begin with that I was struggling to pay off. So, but now I can say I'm currently on a payment plan. I have my license back. I'm still struggling to pay off those fines and fees from years ago, plus the reinstatement fees. I'm still at risk of losing my license. The special insurance that the state, DVS, will also require you to to buy in order to have your license, which is called the SR-22, is also really expensive and a separate cost in and of itself. And all of this cost me nearly $5,000. Excessive fines and fees have taken a toll not only on myself, but as my family as well. Far too often, I've had to borrow money from other family members who are also just trying to make ends meet. And what really saddens and affects me the most is that this has led to severed relationships within the family. And so I'm still, you know, trying to do right with that and make those amends. But excessive fines and fees have taken a toll not only on me and my family, but they also take a toll on the community. So the state should stop suspending licenses because people can't afford to pay for unpredicted traffic tickets that they receive. It is a predatory practice, and the community is suffering heavily from it. It's keeping people stuck in a hole, which can take years to get out of. And it only creates more problems. Somebody who doesn't have money can't prioritize paying off their traffic tickets, and it's just going to send them deeper into debt. This can very well lead to an individual overwhelmed by the pressure and stress of having to pay those fines and fees to fall into a state of despair and anguish, causing them to hurt the community. So let's be proactive in keeping our community healthy. It's time to give people a chance, you know, especially those less fortunate. It's time to give them a chance so they can, you know, escape these cycles of poverty instead of being driven deeper into it. So with that being said, thank you.
Mr. Dore, thank you for your story. And I can tell you, as a prosecutor, for 15 years for the city of St. Paul, the number of times that I heard stories like yours and how I wanted us to be able to change things for you or folks in your position, and you being active with the ACLU and coming up here to testify is very meaningful to those of us who have to change the policy. Your story makes a difference. So please stay in touch. Please stay active with the ACLU. They can put you in touch with us, and hopefully we can affect some change on this. Thank you. Are there any, Representative Cantrell has a question. Who's your question for, Representative Cantrell?
I just wanted to make a brief comment, if that's all right, Mr. Chair.
Sure, absolutely. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Dore, for sharing your story with us. I've personally known many people whose experience in some ways parallels your own, where their license is suspended, essentially as a consequence of being unable to pay fines or to pay fees, and what is somewhat, you know, it is almost a positive feedback loop the way that this is structured, in that in order to punish people, our system suspends their driver's license. Well, then people are forced, as you were, Mr. Dore, into a situation in which they either have to drive in order to make an income to pay off those fees, or if they choose not to drive, if they choose to abide by the consequence that's been imposed upon them, then folks are likely unable to achieve an income. So I just, you know, I really appreciate you sharing your experience. It is it does perpetuate cycles of poverty when we start suspending driver's licenses for things that aren't related specifically to driving related offenses such as DUI and the like. But you know, yes, please keep advocating, Mr. Dore. We should not be perpetuating cycles of poverty and criminalization, setting people up essentially to fail in the state of Minnesota. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your indulgence.
Thank you. Thank you for your question, Representative Cantrell. Members, we've reached the end of our time. However, we still are going to do criminal record expungement. We have been told by House information that we can, in fact, go over time to do this, and that's what we are going to do. And with testifiers, we have Ron Elwood, Lilo Shlunda, Bo Rara, and Bob Small will be testifying again on criminal record expungement. But before that, we have a question we have one more, fines and fees. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, I missed this. Derek Moore is here. I apologize. We're not moving on from this because Derek Moore is here with testimony before the committee too. I apologize, Mr. Moore, but if you can, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
All right, can you hear me fine?
It's really quiet. I can barely hear you. Can you get closer to the mic or something?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, perfect. Perfect.
All right.
Welcome to the committee.
Hi, my name is Derek Moore. I'm 28, and I've lived in Minneapolis for most of my life. I've been suspended since I can remember. I got my first suspension when I was about 16, driving in Apple Valley with no license, just a blue card and a permit. After that, I worked hard for a few years. I got my license back. And then a few years ago, I got suspended again because I was homeless, living in my car, and I just couldn't pay the tickets. So my story is pretty much like everybody else's that you've heard. It's been time and time again. I get pulled over all the time, driving after suspension, driving after revocation, no proof of insurance. And I just want to say it's hard to make it when you live out in a place that buses don't run and you have no money for a bus ride or for a cab to get you 20 miles away to go to work. So, yeah, I don't have much to say because I had a speech written down, but it's pretty much the same as what we've been hearing. So I just want to say, if we can do something better for us, it would definitely help us out a lot. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Moore. And just being here on this hearing, your testimony matters to the members of this committee. And I hope that you will stay in touch as we move forward between now and the regular special sessions where we can affect these policy changes. So thank you. Thank you for weighing in on your policy, and we hear you. We have two questions for Representative Lucero and Chair Johnson. Go ahead, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was actually for the previous testifier. I was curious to know what were the circumstances that his vehicle was towed in Minneapolis initially?
Mr. Dorey, are you still here? Mr. Dorey? We'll get that. Hopefully he hears you and he can get back on.
Okay, and if he doesn't, Mr. Chair, I was just going to share. I've also had a similar experience to his, so I very much identify with what he had. Oh, he's there. I'll let him answer.
Excuse me. My mic was muted. Did you have a question for me?
Yeah, he wanted to know under what were the circumstances under which your car got towed originally?
Parking downtown Minneapolis with, not paying the meter really was what originally caused it to be towed. So, but I had tickets before that, which, you know, I had to pay off in order to even get the car as well. So I was struggling to get all of that at the same time. And other tickets I haven't even went to court for. So those weren't like, we're still in the process of being like judged, I should say.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I was going to say then, okay, so it sounds like that you parked in an area that you didn't pay for the parking meter. I mean, so we all know, each and every one of us, when we park in an area and don't pay the parking meter, we know what we're subject to getting tickets and potentially towed. My circumstance is not identical to yours, but similar. I don't live in Minneapolis. And I years ago, I drove down there to, this was, 15 plus years ago, to get my taxes done by somebody, a tax preparer in Minneapolis. And this was shortly after a snowfall. And I'm not familiar with the even odd, I am now, but back then I wasn't, the even odd plowing. And so I parked and on the road, went in to get my taxes done, came out, my car was gone. It was towed. And so I have a very bad taste in my mouth for the city of Minneapolis. But again, I just, when you said your car was towed, I'm right there with you. It cost several hundred dollars to get out and it is painful.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, members, I just want to make a couple quick comments. I agree with you, Chair Lesh, that the surcharges are way out of line. Now, they were done as a way to temporarily to resolve a budget shortfall. And unfortunately, they haven't gone down. They've increased. 2013, some of those went up again under Representative Hillstrom when she was chair of the judiciary. When I started my career in law enforcement, they weren't bad. Stop sign violation was $30. and now it's gotten way out of hand. For those of you who have received a seatbelt ticket, the fine is $135. But if you look at the statute, the maximum fine is $25. So we have $110 on a $25 ticket of fees and surcharges. We need to find a way to reduce them. Unfortunately, we're looking at a huge budget deficit. And I don't know how we're going to do that, because that's a big hole in the judiciary's budget if we reduce those. I can't remember from last a year and a half ago when we discussed that what those numbers were, but I know it was huge. I wish there was a way we could get them down. One thing I also want to bring up is that these individuals are talking about having their license suspended. We have to remember a driver's license is not a right, it's a privilege. You have a privilege to operate a vehicle if you follow all the rules. If you don't follow the rules, you get a citation. Do we need to address the surcharges and all the fees on top of the actual fine? Yes, we do, but if you're going to drive, you have to follow the rules in order to use that privilege.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Chair Johnson. Was that, and I didn't hear that at the end. Did you have a question for someone on that?
I did not. It was just a statement.
Thank you. Thank you for that statement. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope my internet works today.
It sounds good so far.
Okay. I just had a conversation with my now 23-year-old daughter, who at age 19 and 20 was living in North Minneapolis. And I just thought I'd offer this as support for your bill. She was living, she just starting out, not making a whole lot of money, under $10 an hour, living in a house with lots of other college kids. And she had just purchased a car with the tabs already expired. And so she, you know, went through the process to get the tabs, but did it through the mail. And just in the short amount of time, as she's waiting for her tabs to be, get delivered through the mail, she ended up racking up, I think it was 4 or 5 tickets, because she had to park on the street. She didn't have a driveway to park in because she was in Northeast. And by the time this particular officer got done ticketing her night after night, literally, one night after the next night after the next night, she racked up $300 worth of tickets before she could finally get her tabs in the mail. She got so upset, she finally put a note on her car that said, my tabs are in the mail. Give me a break. I am not making any money. And she was just telling me this morning, she felt like because she was in a poor neighborhood and she was targeted, she couldn't park in a driveway, that they this officer or a set of officers kept coming back night after night to look for her car and ticket it. So in a matter of a week or week and a half, she just was just heavily burdened by all of these tickets. She did not lose her license, but I just wanted to point out to the committee how quickly something like this could happen when you've got officers that are targeting in poor neighborhoods like that. It happened to my own child, and she was so upset. Just trying to make it, you know, she said her rent was less than the amount of tickets that she had racked up that month just because she was waiting for the tabs in the mail. So I just want to offer that it's, you know, all kinds of folks in all kinds of situations, but poverty definitely is a theme throughout. And I just want to offer my support to this bill for that. Thank you, Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony on that, Representative O'Neill. A lot of us will carry the personal stories that we have about this as well. The fines getting racked up and just being ridiculous and unreasonable at this point. Seeing no other questions or testifiers on the fines and fees bill, we are going to move on to criminal record expungement. Folks may recall that we struggled for years to try to find some way to expunge. And this goes also to the question that was posed by Camille Bryant, the assistant public defender previously, is the current effects of the laws and convictions that we have, is that really the intent that the legislature had when enacting these various laws. And I can tell you, as one who served for 18 years, that I see the aggregate effects ratcheted up. And no, the aggregate effect of a lot of these forces, collateral consequences on people that maybe we didn't have when we passed one specific bill. And that's why I appreciate former Representative Carly Moline's work on the House side for expungement. She originally came to me in 2008 to see what we could do with respect to expungement. And we have several testifiers, Lilo Schlunda, Bo Rara, and Bob Small to testify on this. Mr. Elwood has removed himself as a testifier, so we're going to move straight to Lilo Schlunda. Welcome, a legal aid attorney. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Lilo Schlunder, and I'm a supervising attorney at Legal Services of Minneapolis. I represent a coalition of legal aid attorneys, and my colleagues and partners serve the entire Minnesota state. Our clients are families and individuals living in poverty who are coming to us for a variety of civil legal aid issues. One of the areas that we practice in is in the area of criminal expungements. And so I'm here today just to provide input on how the current criminal expungement process impacts the lives of our clients, a little post-2015, as Mr. Chair has mentioned. We know, and there's been testimony already on how criminal convictions can haunt good people's lives long after their sentences were served. We know that under state statute, people with convictions can be denied jobs, housing, public assistance, student loans, state licenses. And in an issue that's dear to my heart, the opportunity to care for their own family members and young children. And we're talking about kinship placements. And it is our opinion that right now there's no better time to be discussing these issues. I commend this committee in recognizing that. We witnessed firsthand in our office the systemic inequities and inequalities that were already described. But for those clients in the communities that we serve, where we have individuals identifying as persons of colors or indigenous, this is an extremely critical issue for our clients. We frankly, you know, we've heard mention of how starting at, you know, the pretrial going all the way through, the system is unequal and set up to fail in many ways. And the expungement piece is kind of the last piece of the puzzle where we're looking for fairness and for equity. I find in our practice and in the process of representing clients for criminal expungement that the process is still fairly laborious, intensive, it's complicated, it's laborious, it's expensive. And that expense piece again raises the issue of inequity. So those with means and access to private attorneys have a much better process or resources to expunge their records. We at Legal Aid are concerned about making the field fair. We're concerned about equality. What we'd like is the success that expungements bring, which is tearing down barriers and making opportunities for employment, housing, and people to support their families. I cannot emphasize how critical this issue is right now in the midst of a global pandemic and an economic downturn. I don't know if you can see the bags under my eyes on the video, but our office is being inundated by people needing help and families needing help. And families are just in an extremely fragile state on the brink of, it feels like total devastation, with people not being able to access housing or employment and are desperate for some assistance. And It just seems one of those areas in which you, the legislature, can have such a deep impact on providing a statute that's fair and really allow people to move on beyond, you know, their mistakes or their worst deeds, whatever it is that occurred to them. So with that, I'm going to turn to my colleague, Bo Rara, who is also practicing in that area and has a very unique perspective when it comes to the youth in our state. So thank you very much. I appreciate you hearing from us.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Schleiner, and for your work. Bo Rara, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am deeply grateful for the opportunity to speak to you on a topic that criminal expungement is. I'm a young attorney, so my experience is limited, but I have my background is that I have represented folks in criminal expungement in multiple counties. Additionally, I was a sentencing clerk in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office and responded to all of the petitions. So I've been on both sides of this issue since 2015. And Minnesota expanded and enumerated felonies that could be expunged. And in many ways, relative to other states, our statute provides more paths to restoring our neighbors to our community by removing the barriers and stigma that come with a criminal history. And we've learned a lot since that expansion. Exciting things are the auto expungement portion of the statute being implemented at last by the Ramsey County in partnership with other county attorneys. I would reframe these housing, employment, public benefits, kinship placements as not collateral consequences, but primary consequences. And I just want to give a timeline to kind of show why it's urgent that we reexamine with the experiences that Ms. Schlender has talked about and many other folks have talked about with the impact of our criminal justice system on the civil side. So if somebody has to wait 5 years from discharge of paper, if they had 3 to 5 years of probation, and I know we've had some change recently around the duration and limits and caps, which is great, but that's still 5 years from that. That's 10 years total that somebody is experiencing those limitations of their criminal history past serving their sentence. I believe everyone's intention is to restore people to our community because they have served their time, because they are our community, and because it's beneficial to the economy. The reality is that a lot of folks will be stuck at that base level, entry level position if they can get past the interview. And then just to give some data, because I heard earlier that data is important and we don't have a really good baseline here in Minnesota yet, but Michigan had the first empirical study with the Harvard Law Review that came out in 2019. And only 6.5% of the folks who are eligible pursue it within the first 5 years of eligibility. And they name a lot of different reasons for that, some of them being what Ms. Schlender spoke to, which is the access, the barriers. Anytime someone has come to me, I explain this is going to be a 6 to 9 month process. So what if that's their Section 8 benefit? You know, that's not going to resolve that issue for them in time to place their voucher or to get a voucher, or, you know, these various issues. Another data point, those who obtain it have extremely low crime rates compared to the general population. So those who get granted an expungement in Michigan, which we're not Michigan, but it's the data we have to look at, they have really low crime rates. And I think that that's indicative of people being rehabilitated and restored to the community. And then really importantly, economically, wages go up by 22% compared to those before expungement. So that I just wanted to use that as something that we could look at. I would love if the Robina Institute at the U of M would do some research on our outcomes here. It's hard to because it's a sealed record. And then I just wanted to speak to inherent authority. So we have the judiciary's inherent authority to seal its own records, and I've seen it granted many times in Ramsey County, which is heartening. In terms of what it does practically, we can't really say. The order itself may be helpful if the record is disclosed before the background check. So I have coached folks that I taught an expungement curriculum to at All Square Minneapolis, where they hire the justice involved individuals. But we coach them on like how to have that conversation. Like, do you disclose it before? Do you disclose it after they realize that you have a record that's still held by the BCA? Because even if the court is giving you the highest possible remedy, it doesn't guarantee you're going to get to have that conversation with an employer. And then I also just want to name that I think public defenders, judges, and county attorneys may or may not understand fully a stay of imposition. There were so many pro se folks representing themselves going in thinking they had a misdemeanor, thinking they were eligible, and they are told by the judge, no, it's considered a felony for purposes of expungement. You're not yet eligible. And it's just, they went through that 6 to 9 month timeline and without access to a civil legal aid attorney. And it's just, it's heartbreaking to watch someone tell their story of rehabilitation and not understand. And I wouldn't have known that before I did any of this. So I just wanted to share those experiences, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all today.
Thank you for being here, Bo Rarad, for offering the stories or being able to see it from both sides is, I think, probably an important perspective that we need to take when we change the policies here. So far, I see no questions from committee members. We do have with us Judge Small weighing in to testify. Welcome, Ms. Small, and welcome back to the committee. Please state your name again.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Robert Small, and I'm the executive director of the County Attorneys Association. I am here this afternoon to testify about this expungement bill and the efforts around changing policies to better differentiate between accountability for crimes committed and second chances for those who, as Chair Lesh mentioned, make one mistake and have the weight of the world around them. Representative Long and Representative Moran have taken the lead in conversations with our association before this bill was even introduced. And our association supports the underlying goals of the legislation. We appreciate that the bill includes the ability for law enforcement to access and use those records where appropriate, as well as the ability for county attorneys to access and use those records to prosecute repeat offenders. In addition, we certainly appreciate the various provisions giving county attorneys discretionary authority to initiate these expungement processes. Now, you may have heard me say this before. You may have heard me testify on another one of Representative Long's bill that was House File 982 on collateral consequences. Our association and the members of our association are constantly struck with the amount of collateral consequences in our laws that one faces for a mistake that a person has made, which results in a criminal conviction. If you look at Chapter 609B, it has at least 29 separate major categories and then many, many, many subcategories under each of those major categories of collateral consequences that follow a criminal conviction. And those cover things that negatively impact employment, housing, licensing, program eligibility, and others. And our association has long believed that our state would be well served by looking at those statutes and carefully evaluating those statutes and what requires meaningful penalties and what should not hold someone back from attaining those things that are needed to successfully turn their lives around and make better members of the community. In other words, our association believes that there are other ways beside or in addition to expungement to address this problem. Given that the current situation is about the expungement bill, again, our association favors the overall concept of the bill. We have formulated a group of prosecutors to engage in dialogue. We appreciate the legislature's highlighting these varying needs of many stakeholders and the ability to bring everybody to the table to move forward in Minnesota. And so while we have met as a group, there are some concerns that have been expressed that we are concerned about. Those things include whether or not there are adequate resources in our smaller offices and even our medium-sized offices to process these expungement processes that are included in this bill. So, Mr. Chair, again, thanks for the opportunity for allowing us to share our thoughts on this. It is a complex area of the law. I want to let you and the committee know that we are committed to be at the table and try to get this right and achieve a better outcome for all Minnesotans. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Judge Small. We have two questions, Chair Johnson and Representative Lucero. Chair Johnson, go ahead.
Chair Lesh, members, I want to thank for this discussion on this bill or this idea. I want to thank Judge Small for saying how the intricacies of it. And there's one area that's being left out. If there is going to be any tort reform, we also have to have, or expungement, there also has to be some tort reform. I'm going to give an example to that happened to where my wife worked at one time at a property management company in the metro area. They had a lady that was renting an apartment. She was the only person on the lease. She decided to let her boyfriend move in. The management company and the owners had no idea he was even living there because it's a large complex. The person, I can't use the words that I really want to use to describe him, was a sex offender. He ended up sexually assaulting a 12-year-old girl at that complex. That was bad enough, but if we don't have tort reform to deal with these issues on this expungement, this is what's going to happen. The property management company got sued by the victim's family because they claimed that they knew that this sex offender was living there. They had no idea, but they lost. So we need to, not if we're going to do expungement, we have to do major tort reform because that's the biggest reason that there's situations where there's handicaps involved in roadblocks for these people that commit crimes to get a job, to get a housing. It's because of the lawsuits if they should they do anything. Because the owners of the company or the management company for the or the landlord would know about it because they did the background check. And if they did anything that would cause somebody to be a victim of a crime, they get sued. So until we deal with the tort reform, expungement, I believe, is going to be a lost cause because it's just going to, in the long run, it's going to hurt everybody even more.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, when I hear stories like that, the first word that comes to my mind is shyster lawyers in the civil arena. Makes me very frustrated. But thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also just wanted to offer, I am very partial and sensitive to this area that we're discussing today, because as I've said in committee before, I'm very thankful that we serve a God of second chances. And anybody who knows me, I've made my share of mistakes. And in many aspects, the only thing that's the difference between myself and another is I didn't get caught. You know, one of the examples I've used, or I have not used, but is a reality, is when I first turned 16, I think one of the testifiers here earlier was talking about how they got pulled over when they were 16. When I was 16, new license, I wanted to test the limits of this new several thousand pound vehicle and what it could do. And one of those areas to test it was on ice skating rinks. And again, I just did not get caught. But when it comes to criminal justice, when I was going through school for my law enforcement background, one of the things I've never forgotten is the truth of the labeling theory and self-fulfilling prophecy. And when you have juveniles or others that get caught up in the system, they do get labeled. And I think it does have a psychological aspect in how people view themselves. So then when it comes to expungement, when I think of even foreclosure and bankruptcy, right, there's a maximum time by which there's a look back period. And I think for bankruptcy, it's 7 years. Maybe I'm incorrect, but there's a recognition that people need to be allowed the opportunity of a second chance in life. And I know this is a very delicate and very situational depending on the crime, but there definitely has to be the opportunity for people to have that second chance. So again, Mr. Chair, I'm just offering words of support. And this is a very delicate, sensitive, and important conversation. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your statements on that, Representative Lucero. By the way, I mean, I still hold it against you that you were probably ruining my ice rink that I wanted to skate on years ago. I'm just kidding. I don't really. I probably did that too. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming in to testify. I do not right now see any other comments. Judge Small, you wanted to weigh in? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could have the chair's indulgence and respond to a question that Representative Johnson raised during the forfeiture discussion. I wanted to respond to his question, but I wanted to check the bill before I did. Might I just respond to that question?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. Representative Johnson raised the issue of the $1,500 threshold. As it relates to being too low for prostitution and sex trafficking offenses. I wanted to check the bill to make sure I was correct. But if you look at line 16.1 of the bill, it only pertains to controlled substances offenses. And so the $1,500 threshold does not apply to any other forfeiture statutes, such as the prostitution statute and the sex trafficking statute. And I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that clarification, Judge Small. I do appreciate it. Members, we've gone well over time, and House media has given us their indulgence on that as well, and we appreciate it. These four issue areas are going to be hallmarks of what we focus on next legislative session and probably the regular legislative session. If we get a chance to move anything in the specials, we will, but it will be a priority for us next year. So thanks again, everyone, for weighing in. There being no other comments from members of the committee, the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.